In the history of the United States, 114 justices have sat on the Supreme Court. That's counting the 9 that are up there right now. Only 4 have been women. But those 4 haven't been the only ones considered for the court. Now a new book takes an in-depth look at the stories of those women who were in consideration to be on the nation's top court, going all the way back to the Herbert Hoover administration. It's called Shortlisted: Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Today we'll talk about that book and the stories of the women who could have but just missed out on making history with one of the authors. Hannah Brenner Johnson is a law professor and the Vice Dean for Student and Academic Affairs at California Western School of Law in San Diego. I asked how she decided to take on this project.
So that's a really big question, and it's going to require me to take us back about a decade in time. I was a new law professor in 2009 at Michigan State University College of Law, and I had a new colleague, Renee Kanaki Jefferson, who is my co-author on this project. We were getting to know each other as new colleagues, and it coincided with the time during which President Obama had this sort of historic 2 vacancies on the Supreme Court to fill spots that were subsequently filled by now Justices Kagan and Sotomayor. Of course, anytime there is a vacancy on the court and there are people who are nominated, there's a lot of media attention paid to that process. And both Renee and I, independently of each other, were struck by the coverage of the nominations for the Supreme Court. So these were 2 women, incredibly qualified, but yet the media focus was on things that, from our perspective, didn't really matter so much as it related to their qualifications for the court. So, for example, there was a lot of commentary about the fact that they were both childless, that they were single. Some reporters queried, you know, who would take them to fancy dinners at the White House if they didn't have a husband or a significant other. There was a lot of commentary on things based on, like, their appearance. And so being academics and scholars, Renee and I decided that rather than just be offended and anecdotally understand why the focus was on things that seemed unrelated to qualifications, that we would embark on a pretty substantial media study. So we took on an empirical research project that ultimately had us read through 4,000 articles that had been published in both the Washington Post and the New York Times dating back to the early 70s. That were focused on nominees to the court. So we were obviously concerned with how these female nominees were being portrayed, but we didn't think that we could effectively study that phenomenon without looking more broadly at how nominees to the court generally were portrayed. So we went through this very extensive study. We and a team of research assistants, law students, read through these 4,000 articles, coded them for a number of variables. And embedded in this literal haystack of articles was one that stood out. It was deserving of what we at the time called the hot pink sticky. So we took a sticky note, literally, on the articles that really sparked our curiosity and our interest. And so there was a particular article we read that was published in the New York Times in the early 70s. And it was about a judge from California. Her name is Mildred Lilly. Now, Lilly was actually shortlisted for the U.S. Supreme Court by President Nixon. This article struck us for a number of reasons. One, as law professors, lawyers, we really had not contemplated that women had been considered for the court before Justice O'Connor became the first woman to occupy a spot on the nation's highest judicial body. And we felt like Judge Lilly, who was clearly qualified to sit on the court, was somebody who we should have been acquainted with throughout our studies. So we sort of had a question about, well, if Judge Lilly had been considered for the court, might there be other women who were similarly shortlisted but never selected? We were also struck in that article, though, that the reporter talked about Judge Lilly not just in light of her qualifications, where she went to law school or, you know, what she had done as a judge, but about what she looked like in a bathing suit. In fact, the reporter commented that she maintained her bathing beauty figure even in her 50s, and also commented on the fact that she didn't have children. So perhaps those comments weren't so surprising, given that this was the 70s and there was a lot of pervasive bias, sexism, discrimination. But our real inquiry was about who, in addition to Judge Lilly, might have been shortlisted for the court over the course of history. And so that is really how the book Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court, has its beginnings. It was through reading that article that prompted us to ask the question, and it took us a decade to do the research, and now I'm talking with you about it today.
So we're right up to date now. That's very good. And you found out, too, in your research that from Franklin Roosevelt, every president except Eisenhower did have a woman on their short list. Talk about that first one you found out about, Florence Allen. Who was she?
So Florence Allen was really a woman before her time. She was a judge from the state of Ohio. She accomplished a series of significant firsts. She was really a trailblazer for women lawyers and ended up being the first woman to sit on a federal court of appeals, the Sixth Circuit. Now, Florence Allen was actually considered by three different presidents for a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Presidents Hoover and FDR and Truman all considered her. Obviously, we know how the story ends. She was not selected, but she really did blaze a trail for women, ultimately to make it onto the court. But I think it's also important to note that even though she did not, make it onto the nation's highest court, she certainly was moved off of many shortlists and was selected for very significant positions within the judiciary and the legal profession. It's really stunning, I think, to contemplate what might have happened if one of those three presidents had, in fact, moved her from the shortlist for the U.S. Supreme Court and actually placed her onto the court. I suspect that the history that followed might look quite different in terms of the gender and even racial diversity on the Supreme Court.
It's interesting, too, that she did make it to some federal courts, the first woman to do that, right?
Absolutely, yes, on the Sixth Circuit. And certainly, even when she made it onto the different courts and other women who broke through that glass ceiling and were appointed to different judicial bodies, the structures then weren't really even situated to accommodate them. So, we know that when Justice O'Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court, there weren't even restrooms available for her. And that was the case in the experience of a number of women who were the first. The structure of, the Supreme Court even was very gendered. The structures of even applying to be a judge were gendered. A number of applications that a potential judicial candidate might fill out didn't even allow for the potential to check a box that you were a Ms. Or a Mrs. It was all written through the lens of the assumption that the judge applicant would be a man. And so through these women's lives and their experiences of eventually breaking through the barriers and getting appointed onto the court, those structures started to change. So we moved, for example, from referring to Supreme Court justices as, Mr. Justice, and just justice will suffice. It has no gender attached to it. It simply describes whoever the person is that's sitting on the court.
Was being on a short list good for these women's careers, or did they just take a beating because of it?
I think the answer to that question is both. Obviously, you can't achieve the desired end. So if we're talking about sitting on the court, you can't get there without first being on the short list. But to the extent that many of these women experienced the short list as the end and were often placed on that list simply because the president who was dealing with the vacancy wanted to sort of appease his base or wanted to provide an appearance of diversity, but really had no intention of making good on that promise, I think that becomes very, very problematic. Certainly, all of the women in the book, and there are 9 women who we write about who were shortlisted but not selected. It is hard to look at any of them and say that their careers were anything less than just, outstanding. They really did shatter through ceilings and they attained very, very prominent positions. But they were precluded from ever making it on to the nation's highest court. So we've got to start somewhere, right? The shortlist is a necessary step along the way, but I think it can also be used really to just preserve the status quo. It allows the president or really anybody who's in a position of leadership picking a candidate off of a shortlist to sort of appease the part of their constituency that may be demanding diversity, but without actually making good on that commitment. And so we do think that there are harms that come from that perpetual shortlisting. But of course, you know, we finally got to a point under President Reagan's leadership where Justice O'Connor was taken from the shortlist and put onto the court. And that fortunately started a bit of a trend, although it is still a bit shocking that, you know, today in 2020, there are still only four women who have served on the nation's highest judicial body.
Well, Sandra Day O'Connor, she got that appointment as President Reagan was really fulfilling a campaign promise. He had promised during the campaign to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court. But you say in the book that it was really the friendship with Justice Rehnquist that put her really on the top of that list. Is it that lack of a friends network that kept some of the women like Florence Allen from making it to appointment?
I mean, I think that that certainly figures into it. You know, as we know, the networks, especially back then, were largely dominated by white men. And for many of the women, gaining access to those networks was challenging, although that wasn't universally the case. We found examples for most of the women in the study who did have the support, the sponsorship, the mentorship of their law school deans, of their, you know, professional colleagues. We saw, for example, that during the time in which Clarence Thomas was being vetted for the U.S. Supreme Court and encountered issues when the allegations about sexual harassment came forth via Anita Hill, we actually saw a judge, John Newman, who came forward and suggested that Amalia Kearse, who's one of the women in our study, a judge on the Second Circuit, replace Clarence Thomas as the nominee. And so those kinds of examples really suggest that that many of the women did have the support of men in their networks. Interestingly, this judge, John Newman, who really kind of went out on a limb in support of suggesting that Judge Kearse be considered for the court, that letter may in fact have contributed to his own undoing, as he was considered for a position on the Supreme Court alongside Justice Breyer. And as we know how history played out, Justice Breyer was in fact selected for that position on the court, even though the men's credentials were pretty much the same. And so, yes, it's true, Reagan made good on that promise, although, as we also point out in the book, he didn't have a fantastic track record overall in terms of appointing women or minorities to the bench. He gets a lot of credit, deservedly so, for selecting Sandra Day O'Connor, but the appointments that followed didn't follow along that trajectory.
Yeah, you say he kind of thought that O'Connor got him off the hook in the end, right?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, you know, our research for this book extended into presidential archives, into the collections of papers and personal and professional effects of many of these women and presidents. And in embedded in one of those investigations, you know, we found a letter, an internal letter that was written to President Reagan alerting him to the fact that there was a lot of criticism about his lack of female appointments to the federal bench and suggesting that if he didn't do something about that, that there was going to be trouble. Obviously, that didn't make much of a difference because his record remained pretty dismal, but for the appointment of Sandra Day O'Connor.
Still to come, we'll talk about another fascinating woman who just missed out on getting the call. And we'll look ahead to the future of women on the Supreme Court. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, any place. Thank you. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. And our guest today is Hannah Brenner Johnson, co-author of the book Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. One of the many quotes that were highlighted in the book was this: a career woman's chief handicap is that she doesn't have a wife. That quote was from Judge Susie Sharp, who in 1975 was elected by North Carolina to be the first woman to serve as Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court in the U.S. She was talked about for the U.S. Supreme Court as early as the Kennedy administration and did make the shortlist for the appointment that eventually went to Sandra Day O'Connor. I asked Hannah Brenner Johnson about Judge Sharp.
Oh, my gosh. Judge Sharp, maybe, well, all of the women are so complex and interesting, but she is extraordinarily so. One of the things that we learned about her is that she really believed that a woman's place either was in the home or in the workforce, but that she couldn't occupy a place in both. And so Judge Sharp ultimately never married. And she devoted her entire life to her judicial career. She did, however, have very significant, intense relationships with three men throughout the course of her life. She's one of the women about whom we know a lot, in part because another scholar embarked on a very extensive biography project about her and was granted access, somewhat unusually, into Susie Sharp's very, very personal journals and diaries and all of her papers. Her family was very forthcoming with information about her, and it was through that research that the revelations about these relationships came to bear. She really benefited, I think, from relationships with other attorneys. So all of the men that she was involved with were lawyers. One of them was a judge. Two of them were married. And so it was it revealed an intense complexity. She was also a racist, which was something that was very difficult for us at different parts of this project because, you know, all of these women brought qualifications to serve on the Supreme Court. I think it'd be really difficult to argue that any of them wasn't qualified, and certainly Susie Sharp is among them. But that doesn't necessarily mean always that we agreed with their perspectives and provided us with a lot of really complicated things to wrestle with throughout this project.
Since Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman on the court, four other women have been nominated. One dropped out. The interesting, and I remember when this happened, of course, I was in the media at the time. Harriet Myers was destroyed by the media. What was her story?
So I think there's a couple of things to say about Harriet Myers. She really took a beating, we believe, based on her gender. I think one of the things that's interesting about Harriet Myers is helps us understand how women are often subjected to even more stringent scrutiny when they're being considered for any position. Some of the things that may have been celebrated, for example, in other nominees to the court, like Myers, for example, was president of the state bar and took on a lot of different leadership roles, as did other men who ultimately made it onto the court. But for the men, that might have been seen as a benefit or something that really made them qualified. But in the case of a woman, either it wasn't enough or it was used against her. And so I think her story is a very, very complex one. I think that it's impossible to really understand what happened to Harriet Myers without really looking at gender bias, discrimination, and the implicit ways that women are often disqualified for positions based on things that have often little to do with the qualifications that they bring to the position.
In the end, is this, and I kept thinking about this as I'm reading, is this a story about men more than it is about women, how they have these great women in front of them and just can't pull the trigger?
I think that's a really appropriate way to think about it. I think, you know, we get a lot of questions from people about the book who want to know what they can do. And I think that something that we can all do, and that's whether we're talking about race, gender, other forms of identity, is to check our own biases, right? You know, all of us bring implicit bias to the table. And we have to be really diligent about asking ourselves, why is it that we select the person that we select, and how might bias play into those processes? And so, I think it's a very complex story. We talk not just about the shortlisting that men do to women, but also the shortlisting that women do to other women and that women do to themselves. So, there are examples in the book, and we certainly have examples from our own lives where we may not put ourselves out there because we think that we're not qualified enough. And so I think that this problem of shortlisting, the solution to it is very complex, and it requires kind of all of us to play a role in solving the problem. At the end of the book, we talk about strategies for surmounting the shortlist. And we talk about strategies that are both individual in nature and also more systemic or structural in nature. It's not a problem with a one-size-fits-all easy fix, but one that's going to take a lot of time. And it's our hope that by telling the stories of these women, both individually and then importantly collectively, that we will move the needle forward and get to a point where we can see more gender and racial diversity reflected, not just in the Supreme Court, but across all of our professions.
Well, that brings us to one last thing. Earlier, we spoke about President Reagan's campaign promise to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court. And of course, that's where Sandra Day O'Connor got her appointment. Vice President Biden has promised, if he is elected president, to appoint a woman of color to the Supreme Court. More progress.
Yes. Yes. I think it's a very noble and brave thing for this presidential candidate to say. My guess is that he will make good on it. I think for a long time we heard that there simply weren't qualified women or qualified women of color or qualified minority candidates for any position. But we all know that that is simply not true. You look around at the Black women who are leading law schools and are occupying positions on the federal circuit courts and leading corporations and, teaching law and managing law firms. And it is simply impossible to say that there is not a qualified pool from which he will be able to select somebody. I think it'll be a challenging position. We, of course, identified one woman, Amalia Kearse, who is a judge on the Second Circuit, who we think would be an excellent Supreme Court justice. Whether Biden will consider her or not, hard to say, but certainly there's a pretty significant talent pool from which to select somebody. And we are waiting with bated breath to see what might happen.
Hannah Brenner Johnson is a law professor and the vice dean for student and academic affairs at California Western School of Law in San Diego. The name of her new book, written with co-author Renee Kanaki Jefferson, is Shortlisted: Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Yes, the Supreme Court has historically been a boys' club, but there have been some pretty historic clubs for women. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Not all book clubs are alike. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jean Lee Cole, professor of English, examines one from history that was more than meets the eye.
The Women's Literary Club of Baltimore, that's women's with an A, included members of Baltimore's most prominent families and met weekly for over 50 years between 1890 and 1941. Nevertheless, they have been completely left out of local history. My students and I are seeking to remedy that. We've transcribed over 3,000 pages of handwritten meeting minutes, accounts of weekly meetings that provide a fascinating glimpse of what women read, talked about, and wrote during the first half of the 20th century. We expected the Women's Literary Club of Baltimore to be like the book clubs we're familiar with today, women reading books together for self-improvement and as an excuse to socialize. But we discovered that these women did not just read other people's work. Many were published authors in their own right. Some, in fact, were incredibly prolific. They published novels and short stories in the most highly respected magazines of the day. Volumes of poetry, translations, books and articles on history, philosophy, music, art, and dance. We found over 50 published authors among the 300 or so women who belonged to the club. So far, we have recovered over 1,000 publications, greatly expanding what we know about Baltimore's literary history. Baltimore has plenty of well-known heroes, Edgar Allan Poe and Babe Ruth to start. Now we know that men were not the only Baltimoreans who accomplished great things. Women have always made up at least half of the human population, but remain hidden. As we commemorate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote, projects like this one show how much we still need to do to bring women back into the light.
That was Jean Lee Cole of Loyola University, Maryland. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.